All right, well, hello and welcome everyone to today's VentureForge. Are these podcasts or webinars now? We've changed tack. Are we podding now?
No, we're stepping up.
We're podcasting.
Who knows?
Officially podcasters.
But today we're going to talk to you with each other about what truly drives Amazon's operational success. When I read that title, is it what drives operational success on Amazon, or why are Amazon so operationally successful? And when you think about that last bit, it's like, probably not if you work on Amazon.
Yeah. So
could be quite an interesting conversation today. Before we kick off, let's do a few intros. I think you're probably all fed up of seeing me now, but I'm Andy Banks. I'm the CEO of VentureForge. We're a commercial partner for leading Amazon brands here in the UK. I'm joined by some fantastic guests today, some who you've met before, some who you may not have done. Let's start with the familiar faces. Travis, hello.
Hey, everyone.
Hello again.
I'm Trav, head of vendor services here at VentureForge. I've been in the Amazon game going on 7 years now. Feels a lot longer than that, in all honesty.
That's my line.
Sorry, steal your thunder. You can use it. We can edit. Started my career at Amazon. Started in the beauty team, health and personal care. Went into pharmaceuticals and then in the agency game. So essentially hit the Holy Trinity, as we call it, from the Amazon side of things, and looking forward to being part of the podcast.
I'm glad you've now not introduced yourself as an ex-Amazon drug dealer.
You know how it goes.
You just drop line. Thank you, Trav.
Where there's the demand, there's supply.
Emma, can you beat that introduction?
There's no deal in here. No. So I'm Emma. I'm head of seller at VentureForge, and I've been within the e-commerce space for over 10 years now. Started straight out of uni and never looked back. I've worked agency, I've worked brand side, so I've sat at both sides of the table really, so it's nice to bring that to this Amazon table now.
So we've got two poachers turned gamekeepers.
Amen.
I like it.
Fair enough.
And to left, a familiar face to me, but possibly not to other people that are watching. Ant, how are you?
I'm good. I'm Ant. I am the senior e-commerce manager at Lansano. I have been in e-commerce now probably 17 years. Eight of those with Amazon, as it clearly shows. So yeah, I mean, it's all been on brand side. I haven't done the Holy Trinity. I've never been on the agency side. That is like, you know, the whole other level for me.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. But you know, I hope that the experience I can bring today is going to be useful for at least one person.
That's all right.
It will be.
I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be.
Thank you, Ant. Well, look, before we dive into today's conversation, obviously this is a newer format for us. We used to do these as live webinars where we brought questions in. The format now is a little bit different. So if you're watching this live and for the first time, if you look, where's it going to be? Somewhere down here, somewhere on the bottom of your screen, there will be a little Q&A icon. So if you want to ask a few questions, we've got some of the team on if you're watching this live. We'll keep prompting you throughout, but ask your questions. There's a few of the VentureForge guys on the chat and on the Q&A that will answer any questions that you want to ask. And in a few seconds, we're also going to pop a poll up because it'd be great to see what your challenges are with Amazon and your Amazon operations right now. In fact, let's jump straight into that. So ask your questions, bob them in the chat somewhere down here. But if things go to plan and you're watching this for the first time, you should now see a little poll popping up on your screen. And I'd love to know what are your biggest operational challenges with Amazon right now. I'm going to read from my screen down here so I get this right. Is it fulfillment speed and reliability? Is it managing inventory? Is it chargebacks, shortages, or compliance issues? Is it packaging and prep? Is it resource and internal team structure? And it's not on my list, but we'll get this added in true quiz show fashion. Or is it finally all of the above? And I suspect there's probably going to be a fair few people
all of the above.
Ticking that all of the above box. So look, we'll... You guys, Bobby, answering to that poll, if you're watching this live, we'll jump into the conversation. I'd love to start out talking around foundations and mindset around Amazon operations. Why is Amazon operations so important? You know, we often talk to clients, guys, about growth and marketing. That's probably where most of our conversations start. Why should a brand care about Amazon operations?
So I think operations are the fundamentals of Amazon. Okay. If you can't get stock into Amazon and into the customer's hands,
can't sell it.
Yep, that's it. I mean, it doesn't matter how good your deals are, how cool your content is, what type of advertising you do. If you don't have stock there, it means nothing. Mm-hmm. So operations are the fundamental of Amazon. It's not the sexiest part of Amazon, being in the warehouse, having the hard hat, having the high-vis vest, picking, packing, sorting, palletizing. It's really not exciting, but if you can execute it properly, you're onto something beautiful within Amazon.
And that's the thing, executing it properly. It's the last thought of sort of part of selling on Amazon. I think you want to sell, you're keen to sell, but the logistical and the operational side of things is the most important part of it. Doing it right. Amazon is so restrictive. If you don't do it right, you're off.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think the problem is that getting the stock in the first time is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a great launch, you're sitting well, but then you go out of stock. Going out of stock on Amazon is probably the least thing you want to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, ultimately, if you go out of stock, you've wasted all the hard work you've done already, and operations is the key factor of that.
Yeah.
And it's probably, and as you said, it's the most time consuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, if you run out of stock, that's it. You lose the listing, you cede the buy box to any resellers, or your competitors come in, you can't advertise.
Organically,
you lose your seller rank. It just falls to bits, and ultimately, customer experience. I mean, if you're a customer and you want something, you expect it to be on Amazon. If it's not there, you're like, okay, well, why am I going to come back? I've had one chance, not there. Let me just get a D2C. And there you've lost that sale, essentially, mm-hmm. through your Amazon channel.
Yeah.
It's. I often say being out of stock on Amazon for a week costs you 4 to 6 weeks worth of sales. Your point about your organic rankings, that's BSR dropping down. It goes. And by the time you're back in stock and you've got to build that back up again, you're back into spending more on advertising to chase that BSR back, to chase your velocity back. That costs you more money and often caused by a lack of foresight and planning of stock, which could have stopped all of that happening.
And it's scary how many businesses aren't aware of how one small stock outage can affect the entire business within Amazon. Because like you said, organically, it can hit you really hard.
Yeah. Well, it's also not just the organic side. I think we're going to go down a rabbit hole here out of stock. So let's keep it whilst we're on it. For me, it's not just being out of stock that's the issue. It's having enough stock in Amazon. They shall remain nameless, but we've got a client at the moment who has got some vendor challenges, and their best-selling lines have been held at 7 days stock cover on vendor. Sounds all right. It doesn't sound ideal. You'd like more than 7 days stock cover. But the problem with that is when there's only 7 days stock cover, that probably means there might be 10, 20, 30 items. If they're sat in a DC up here and a DC down here and there's none in the Leeds DC, that product all of a sudden goes on a 5, 6, 7 day lead time on Amazon, whereas all the competition is on Prime next day delivery service. So it's not just the out of stock, it's the fragmentation of stock and not enough holding that can absolutely decimate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. Customers go there for convenience. I mean, end of the day, if you want to buy something on Amazon, you'd want it yesterday already. Well, that's how quick you expect it to come. If you can get it by same day before 10 p.m., win a chicken dinner. But if you can get it next day, that's the whole goal of Amazon. You don't want to have to wait 3, 4 days for your vitamins or your dog food or your face creams. You pay Prime subscription for a reason. I abuse it. I'm sure you abuse it. I mean, it's like you want to get your money's worth, essentially. You don't want to have to wait 3, 4 days for something to be delivered. You might as well just get off your sofa then go to a local supermarket and buy it. Then, you know, you've got it.
Do you not think Prime's got people even beyond that point of not expecting it? It just becomes natural behavior. So I'm buying something. I've got a DIY job at the weekend. So it's Monday, I'm buying it. I don't need it till Saturday. I'm still pissed off if I can't get it by Tuesday. And it's just subconscious in the Amazon customer's mind. I expect it tomorrow.
You expect it the next day. Yeah. And the problem is it's not, I think that it's the 10 o'clock in the evening shopping. It's the, I'm lazy on the sofa, I need something, I click, 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 and it's there by 1 o'clock the next day. It just takes the challenge of getting a product out of the consumer's mind.
But for
you know, it's just right there. But just going on to what you were saying about the Amazon stock and holding the low availability. I mean, we have had challenges like that before, but there are tricks around of how to manipulate the vendor a little bit as well. You know, there are, we have successfully tried Born to Run to push the stock levels back up again. At the moment, we have a very good system where we can watch the levels of stock, both on vendor and seller. And then depending on how low they get, we start to manipulate the Born to Run system, or we make sure that our internal reports are flagging our warehouse to make sure our Seller Central is always up to date. Mm. So we're never getting to those positions where Amazon is potentially going to go out of stock or necessarily lose the Prime badge.
So we're 9 minutes in. I wondered how long it would take for us to start talking about hybrid. And that wasn't
a new record.
That's all right. It's 9 minutes and the hybrid conversation has come up. Well, hold that thought. I'm sure we're going to get onto that in a second.
It's going to come.
Yeah. I mean, you said something interesting. Operations is that the heart of Amazon. It's the most important part. Nobody comes to us and goes, hey, guys, can you fix my Amazon operations? They always come with, can you fix a profitability challenge? Can you help me grow quicker? So why is, I think we've touched on why the operational piece from a stock point of view is so important. What about from a profit perspective? You know, how important is it to have that slick operation regardless of model?
it's vital, because operationally, if you get something wrong and you're getting, I don't know, shipments refused from FBA warehouses or fulfillment centres, that's going to cost you money. Yeah. It's going to cost you money to get it sent back. A simple thing that I've seen cost a business thousands was the misplacement of a SKU sticker. They didn't put the sticker on properly, and it got to the warehouse, and Amazon were like, absolutely not. Can't scan it, send it back. Mm-hmm. And that cost a business thousands to re-sticker products.
Yeah.
It's the tiny things that you do not even realize could cost you money, but it's Amazon, so it will.
A couple of my favorite stories is one, I think it's one of those industry stories that's done the rounds numerous times. A brand that was sending product into Amazon and getting hit with penalties for not being compliant with their inbound shipments. Mm. And the brand's going, how can we not be compliant? We're getting our products in there early every time. We're getting it in on our vendor account ahead of the deadline. Well, that's not on time. You're early. Amazon doesn't want it early. They don't want it late. They want it in the time frame.
Yeah.
They want it to fit in that particular window. And we had a client a few years back, you know, we'll keep them nameless because it's the right thing to do, but they were a seller client who had been shipping into Amazon some very expensive, very bulky, heavy products. So from an FBA point of view, very costly to ship to the customer, but also very costly to pull back out of Amazon if you wanted to take the stock back. They had a container load arrived at Amazon and they'd been shipping in for months, you know, years at this point. Amazon rejected it because their packaging wasn't compliant. And the client was, well, you've accepted it for the last 2, 3, 4 years. So, well, yeah, but it's not compliant. Just because you've got away with it and we haven't picked up on it doesn't mean it's compliant. And the client was faced with two options: dispose of the stock, and you were talking tens of thousands, or have it shipped back so they can repackage it and deal with it. And they were 25 kilo bags. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the FBA fee on that, a container load of bags, neither option was viable. Either option was going to cost them an absolute fortune. So missing that operational requirement, even though they'd got away with it, absolutely bit them in the backside.
Yeah, you really have to be so careful. And that's the whole strategy of doing test runs, ensuring that you're testing how operationally you're working, whether that will be accepted by a warehouse. But like you said, sometimes they change their mind. Yeah. Like, we've had clients ship things in for years, never had a problem. Suddenly, the warehouse have sent, you need to pay an extra 75 pence per package for us to put this in a clear bag so that it's better for us to distribute. And you're talking about tens of thousands of units at 75 pence a cost. Like, it's the small things that you just really don't plan
for.
Yeah.
It hits
your P&L big time.
Oh, well, totally. I mean, but I think if you look at it, everyone looks at profitability as the margin between the sale price and the cost of goods for the business. But actually, if you really want to drive profitability, it's the efficiency in the operations.
True P&L.
If you can, and operation is probably one of the most time-consuming jobs as well. If you can drive efficiency in man hours and costs as well, you'll suddenly be making 5, 10, 15 points above what you were expecting to make. And I think that's where the businesses are making the disconnection, that they treat operations as a minor task when actually should, as we've said, it's the priority. Yeah. Get your operations solid, the rest will follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's kind of a double-edged sword on that as well, because obviously if your operations aren't correct, you're going to get chargebacks, you're going to get purchase quantity variances, PPVs, shortages, overbillings, all those exciting things. But with that, if you can't service it, when it comes to AVN season, they're going to say, hey, look, your logistics aren't up to par. What do you think of picks? What do you think of direct fulfillment? What do you think of vendor flex? And then you're going to be paying twice, essentially. So you're losing on shortages and you're losing leverage in negotiation later on down the line. So it's quite a double-edged sword. If you can't get your internal metrics correct, you're losing on manpower, you're picking slower, you're delivering later, you're getting chargebacks. And then when AVN comes around, they're going to be pitching you all these programs that you don't need. So you're losing in all fronts.
You pay two or three times.
Yeah.
And on that other point that you said there, the dimensions, it's not just the dimensions of the products of the shipment you're sending in, it's the dimensions of the products themselves. And again, that's another a point that people miss, is efficiencies of the dimensions, especially when it comes to FBA.
Yes.
You get those dimensions right, you start to look at the costings and go, well, can I move the product from band C to band B? Again, that's where you drive efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think particularly your point about the cost in operations being important, when you look at a P&L, it's hidden. In my opinion, it's hidden when you look at an Amazon. I'm going to use seller as an example here. You look at a seller business and you sell something. You knock your VAT off, you pay your referral fee, you pay your FBA fee. FBA fee is kind of a variable cost. Mm-hmm. Your referral fees are variable cost, but you can't influence any of that stuff. Okay. No. Amazon will charge you 15 point whatever percent on that. They'll charge you X pounds to ship your goods. So as you start to work down your P&L, you're left with a margin at the bottom. Most people think advertising is the bit you can play and tweak, but if you're going to compete in a market, you're going to spend the same as the competition. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of got that set. So when you work your way down that P&L and go, where can I save some cash? Where can I deepen that margin? You then find this line called COGS. And that's where all that operational nastiness, but also efficiency, is absolutely buried within. To your point on FBA cost, I think that's a massive missed element on the seller side of things. I used to run a brand separate to the agency, and we sold about that size, a skincare product that sat in a box about the size of a mug, and it might have been $2.75 to ship that. I couldn't control that cost. You know, I had a tin of product. The tin had to be a certain size to fit 150 mil inside. The box had to be a certain size to fit the tin inside. I couldn't shave air off that product anywhere. What we realized was if we sold two of them, it was two times the FBA cost. If we sold three of them, it was three times the FBA cost. If we did a 4-for-3 bundle and wrapped in a little bit of plastic packaging and barcoded it, the FBA cost for shipping four items only really doubled. So we sold three items, we gave away four, we made significantly more margin because we've been able to get that FBA cost to behave in a slightly different way. So although you can't, well, you can tweak it by shrinking your product, once you get to that point, things like bundling can start to give you some more control over that, that FBA cost.
We talk about bundling more and more these days. Yeah. I think it's a way of maintaining that profitability, selling more of your product. If you can bundle a high margin product with a low margin product and sell the two together, it's going to work much better for your business.
Yeah, complementary products that go together.
Yeah, 100%. But then the caveat to that is virtual bundling.
Yeah.
Bundling is, everyone's like, oh, we're bundling, but you're not, because all Amazon's doing is charging you for one and charging for the second one. Yeah, so you're getting double FBA fees in the end of the day.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can't track those, maybe, well, specifically on vendor virtual bundling. We're like, can we have some data on? They're like, well, no, because it's just a component from one and the other.
Two orders.
Yeah.
And it's also a terrible CX. I've done, like, I've bought a virtual bundling, and hey, this is awesome, this is cool. Came in two separate packages, two separate times of the day. I'm like, well, what's the point of that, essentially? So yeah, virtual bundling has its place in the world, but I'd say if you can hard bundle, good CX, better average order value.
I think it's a great place to test a bundle theory and go, do these products work together? Give it a couple of months, see what the sales are. I mean, as we say, it's hard to track the sales, but you can still track the sales.
Yeah.
You can work it out.
You can see the correlation.
You can see the correlation. Yeah. And then you go, right, then now it's worth either to design packaging for that, or to then to do something in your warehouse where you just cling wrap it together.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what we've been doing. We've been testing bundles, not necessarily from a virtual side, but actually just from putting two products together, cling wrapping them, setting them in, testing the theory out, and then then going into production later, going, we're going to package these properly, and then create the experience now that the final consumer wants, because we have the evidence to prove it's there.
Yeah,
and it's driving sales.
Yeah, and if you can create it with like a nice packaging and it looks good and it's saying unique, that's where you go to Amazon. You're like, hey, look, I've done an exclusive product for you. You know what I mean? You get your VM on your side, you get your AVS on your side. I'm increasing your catalog, I'm increasing your margin, we're increasing our margin, no price matching. You got an exclusive. You know, it's not really an exclusive. It's just the individual components put in nice packaging and sold as one unit, essentially.
Yeah, and that's where product dimensions come in as well. If you can go to Amazon, especially in negotiation season, and go, look, best-selling product, I've knocked it down a shipping ranking. We don't see it, but Amazon sees it. They go, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all there. You've got to play both sides very carefully.
Sticking with packaging, one of the brands I saw doing something absolutely brilliant, I think it was Nutrition Geeks. I think I shared it with you guys the week. You may not tell, but I buy creatine. It's not working.
I'm refilling out that.
Are you drinking enough water?
Yeah. I'm probably not going to the gym. That's probably part of the recipe that's missing. But every brand that I've come across sells that in a tub. Mm. And that's voluminous. That's expensive to ship. And I ordered almost by accident from Nutrition Geeks. And what turned up was almost an A5 Jiffy bag type envelope full of white powder. We're getting back into your old world, actually. The stuff on Amazon. They've engineered the same product that Applied Nutrition is selling in a 500-gram tub into a small and light type package. So they've taken what probably for other brands is a 3-4 quid item from an FBA point of view and moved it down to a £2-ish delivery cost. A couple of quid.
Yeah.
That literally sits in that FBA fee that all of a sudden, from being a little bit smarter, I strongly suspect a plastic A5 jiffy bag is cheaper than a plastic tub
it's
to
like
buy.
Envelope posting.
They've
isn't
just
it?
Engineered that product unique to Amazon. Yeah. To your point, it works. From an operations point of view, it's not going to crack, it's not going to get damaged.
And it's probably margin rich. I mean, especially from the vendor side of things, you obviously don't see Amazon's contribution margins because that's all internal facing. How much does it cost to pick, pack, man hours, all those good things. But obviously, it's going to be a lot easier to stack a whole lot of envelopes than it is to be stacking a whole load of tubs, essentially. So chances are Amazon's not going to come knocking saying, hey, your net PPM's having a hammering because you've got healthy margin on it. The packaging's less, the size is less, takes less place in the warehouse. Probably easier to pick and sent through.
From a seller perspective, you're paying so much less storage fee. You can get more of your product into a warehouse for almost half the price.
Yeah, and then also the shipping into Amazon as well, because then you're shipping more at less. So it's a full circle.
It's win-win-win. Yeah. I think for me, that's the true sign of that mature Amazon business. You've got brands that are doing very well. I'll use Applied Nutrition as an example here. Fantastic brand. You know, we've had people in our team that have come from that business. Fantastic brand. Very, very good at Amazon. Great at what they do. But you compare that to Nutrition Geeks and how they're getting their product into Amazon, operationally, a different level of maturity. Okay. Amazon-specific product, cheaper to ship in, less likely to get damaged, cheaper to ship out. Great experience when it lands. Still feels fantastic. Ticks the little geeky box for me. Bloody hell, they've done a good job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they've thought about it.
Yeah.
We've gotten on a real rabbit hole here around the whole packaging thing. Maybe do a bit of a round robin. What other operational challenges do you see for vendor businesses, seller business? What have you seen in your world, Dan? What are the other challenges that you're seeing operationally?
Definitely chargebacks is still always a hot topic. I mean, PQVs, PPVs, so purchase price variances, purchase quantity variances, shortages. So that's always going to be something. A lot of businesses are bringing it in-house, which is great. But on vendor, if you have historical issues, you can't look past 90 days, I think it is at the moment. So you need a plug-in for tech. And I mean, we've got a tech partner that does a great thing where they can look up to 3 years on shortages and recover some of those lost bits and pieces, essentially on overbilling shortages. So chargebacks, I think, is always going to be the hot topic. And then also liquid prep. So within Amazon, not many people know it. Yeah, is if you ask your VM or your AVS for the liquid seal matrix, they'll give you a nice little printout of all the liquid criteria needed for Amazon. So it does need to be vacuum sealed, does need to be induction sealed, does need to be cling filmed or double layered, essentially. If it's none of that, Amazon's going to baggy it and charge you 80p a bag. Mm-hmm. And if you're selling thousands of units a month, you start hemorrhaging margin once you fix that in. So any tips on customers that sell more liquidy products, ask for the liquid seal matrix and ask your VM or your VM or AVS put you in touch with the in-stock team to fix that issue, essentially, else you're paying 80p per transaction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think another one would be is setting out very good, clear SOPs, especially for your, you know, maybe in-house, maybe for the warehouse. As long as there is a standard document that tells them exactly how to do it, because Amazon has the criteria. As long as you stick to the criteria, you're good. You know, outside of that, so if you have a good standard working SOP, generally you can minimize those mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one, to be honest. Like that, especially if someone's new to your business or someone's off sick and someone needs to cover. Mm-hmm. I mean, shrink wrapping, or palletized wrapping is wrapping, but it's really not. It's where you place the label. It's how high it is when it comes to case back ordering quantities. There's so many small nuances within it.
The number of times I've heard, it's okay for Very. I ship into Very like that and I sell more to them than I do to Amazon, or I ship into Argos and they're okay with my standards. It's not the game.
You're
shipping to Amazon and they're very, very specific.
We always get compared to Argos, Amazon and Argos. I was like, Argos is completely different.
Yeah,
it's like, well it is. Thanks for pointing that out. It is.
Little tip from me here, but it was a massive eye-opener to me into Amazon's operations. Book yourselves on a DC tour. Amazon open up their warehouses and invite people to go on DC tours. You can literally go with your family, with your kids, and get a tour around. We occasionally do it when we get brands together. In fact, I haven't done it in a while. We should probably get one of those organized. But when you go around that DC and the way they run the tours, they take you through beginning to end. Here's how we receive. Here's how we split it out into totes. Here's how it gets stored. Here's how it moves around on random robots across 22 football pitches in the DC. Here's how it's picked. Here's how it's consolidated. Here's how it's sent out the door. When you see that end to end, all of a sudden for me, the pennies drop. It's like, right, now I know why I have to prep my package the way that I do, why every product's got to be barcoded, every outer's got to be barcoded, every pallet's got to be barcoded, why that matters in the process. And I think if you're a brand, go and see it. Get yourself on a DC tour, go watch it end to end, and the penny will drop. Take your warehouse team.
It helps you understand why and how products go missing when they get to warehouses, because you can see how they work with the products.
Yes.
So the barcoding thing, everything needs to be barcoded, inners, outers. You need to be able to keep track of that product.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That, I mean, that barcode in the Amazon world is the holy grail. Mm. Yeah, whether it's the package barcode, the outer barcode, or the pallet barcode, when that goes into Amazon, they can get contained into totes as they move around. The tote has a barcode that the barcode or a barcode is literally the Bible.
Yeah.
I've been around some non-Amazon DCs and seen things that looked smart to me, where, for example, selling suitcases. Suitcases are shipped into the country like a Russian doll, the small ones in the medium one inside the large one. Part of me is going, that's brilliant. I love how they've done that. From an operational point of view, in a warehouse, absolute disaster.
Yep.
How do you know where the small one is? Like, it's hidden in the medium one, which is hidden in the large one. Mm-hmm. Amazon brings it in, breaks it up, puts it away as an individual item, actually quite randomly. But yeah, go and see that. It changes your mind.
You touched on the randomly. I picked that up as on the warehouse. You'll walk past some of the inventory and it's like a board game next to pillow casing, next to suitcases, next to a Nutri bullet. And you're like, makes no sense, but it's organized chaos, and it goes back to the barcoding and where it actually sits within it. Because if you can pick, pack, store something quicker than possible, it gets out of the door quicker, essentially. So it's built essentially for convenience to get out of the door quicker. Absolutely. More than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, those DC tours worth the weight in gold. I think one of the things it opened me up to is coming to seller operations, the value of using at times Amazon's own carriers. So big tip, or big thing they open me up to, is if you use UPS rather than your own carrier to send in, UPS will distribute directly into individual Amazon centers. Whereas if you're using your own carrier, it will go to one of Amazon's receiving centers. Then that takes another 2, 3, 4 days to be received, split up, move to a local DC and hit the pick face. So at certain times, there's a real advantage of using UPS to get each package directly into its own DC and get stock much closer to the pick face. Can cost more, but if your priority is get stock to the pick face.
That's a conversation that we have a lot. Using their preferred shipping method does go a long way. It may be more costly, but it might save you a lot of money in the long run, because that courier knows exactly how Amazon operate. Yeah. So even the smallest things make such a difference in how they drop that parcel off or that pallet off.
Yeah. Right, we've talked hybrid at 9 minutes in. I've let you get away with it till 30 minutes in. But there's clearly very, very big differences. This is all about operations, but there's clear differences in why a brand might want to do one model or the other, and then clearly massive challenges about how you handle operations differently across each type. Mm. Maybe let's go outside of operations a little bit, and then we'll come back into why would a brand choose to do vendor versus seller, and in the seller world, why would they talk about FBA versus FBM, or maybe even SFP? Mm-hmm.
I think it's just capabilities, in all honesty. Some brands prefer getting a PO, picking, pack, and sending it off. Some brands just don't have the capabilities to do their own forecasting in their own warehouse space. They prefer to package up, send to Amazon, and that's that. Agree a cost price, and Amazon handles the rest. So I think it really comes down to personal preference. Also, vendor is invite only. So most brands, if they can get into vendor, they'd probably prefer it, because then they know, okay, what they order is what they get, and that's that. Yes, you lose price control. Yes, you relinquish a lot of other controls, but it really just depends on circumstance. So I think most brands will go into vendor or seller, vendor if they do get the invite. But again, I don't want to go into the hybrid topic again. It's always good just to have...
Oh, we're going there. We're going there.
Then it's good to always have the hybrid model in your back pocket. So if you need to do price control, if you need to do new launches, Vine, for example, is really underutilized. So vendor, for some reason, it's £1,900, which... extortionate. You go on seller, Saks Fifth Avenue,
free of charge.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Or like 109 quid for up to 30 enrollments. Exact same vendor exact same ASIN code, just reflected onto vendor. You've got all the reviews and the ratings for a fraction of the cost. So I think it really depends on the ways and the means of the company and what your personal ambitions are and capabilities are.
I think it gives you a lot more product strategy as well. Mm. You know, obviously, vendor's great for low price items, seller, high price items. You know, you can then be quite clever about where you place your products and how you place your products. You know, having that hybrid just gives you that element of control that you lose either just using one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. So if you're not getting enough POs in or anything like that through vendor, you're like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. Boom, slap it on seller, and then you can start getting that in. Yeah.
I mean, this is where I got quite excited when you started to talk about your strategy, because we talk about hybrid. A lot of our clients are doing hybrid, mm-hmm. and the trend I'm probably seeing the most is big brands, brands that the everyday consumer would recognise are typically or were typically vendor. Pure Amazon brands, I guess, were typically seller. But what you're seeing for me is this trend of major brands that were vendor starting to really use that hybrid model. And I think a lot of it, from my perspective, is for operational backup, operational rigidity and flexibility. What I think you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, Amber, when you opened up with a bit of your intro, it sounds like you're not just vendor-seller hybrid, you're vendor-seller and under-seller. You've got FBA, FBM?
Oh, no, we've just
FBA.
We just FBA. I did a big project with FBA, FBM, just to work out, you know, could we bring FBA back in-house? Is it more cost-efficient? Mm-hmm. To be fair, again, this will be purely down to the business itself and the products that you sell. The products we have, it doesn't work out. FBM by far was beating rates by 30, 40, 50% of some of the 3PLs. So, you know, we've done the research, we're sticking with FBA, but that doesn't necessarily mean other businesses with different products that FBM isn't the way to go. You know, like we discussed earlier, I think FBM works potentially with bundling. You know, you can have single products in FBA, but then if you want to start bundling products and you don't want to send the big bundles into Amazon and pay the higher FBA fees, you can then bundle in an FBM where your pick pack is a single charge, is not a single charge per product, and you can send it out that way. So that's another way of looking at it as well.
That's quite interesting. You clearly know your own business very, very well. Mm. You know, hidden in there is clearly a really good piece of work to understand where you operationally good and where you're not operationally as good. So I think what's coming through from here, I'm making a big assumption. You're a B2B brand predominantly. I'm guessing you're selling into people like Boots, Superdrug. Yep. You've got Amazon as a B2B customer to some extent, although it might behave a little bit B2C. But it seems like you're very clear that you're not a direct-to-consumer efficient monster. So you shipping your own parcels out of the door, from what you've said there, is more expensive than doing FBA. So you know where you're strong, you know where you're weak, you know where you can fight and where you're making money.
Exactly. I think, you know, we were historically B2B all the time. And, you know, COVID comes along and suddenly B2C changes everything. Yeah. So we have been playing the catch-up game about D2C, websites, all that kind of stuff. We are now in a far better position. We have a fantastic team running the website. We've got a really good team running the Amazon. And from that, it's been able... And this is where all the work comes from, is because all these avenues start to open and you start to think, well, how about this and how about that? You know, I think a business need, depending on the type of business, you need to be flexible. You need to be able to play in both sides of the market. Yeah. When it comes to Amazon as well, you can't just sit in a B2B model. You have to be able to take a step back, look at the bigger picture and go... Can probability on Amazon B2B is great, but if I did it on B2C, how will that change? You know, will I make a few extra points on a certain product because then I can control the price? And it's a lot of work, but you do that work, you'll pay the dividend later.
So how have you managed in your business then? You've gone from this digitally immature place pre-COVID, I'm guessing, and I mean that respectfully, almost every big B2B business was digitally immature until they had to become mature. But now you're operating this vendor seller model. How are you managing that in your DC? You know, from an operations point of view, how have you become, I'm assuming, really good at the vendor side of things and not getting smashed with chargebacks and all that kind of stuff? And equal on the seller side of things, which is different. You have to operate differently. Stock goes in a different way. How have you got the team up to a place where...
I think it goes back to what I said earlier. Good, solid SOPs. We've taken the time, we've gone into the warehouse, we've gone, this is vendor, this is how we do it, this is seller, this is how we do it, you know, and it's a very clear distinction. You know, from that, we also then, you know, looking at the fact of a lot of our products do probably still use the Amazon sticker and not the manufacturer barcode. Mm-hmm. And that, again, sets a mind in, it costs us a little bit more, but in the warehouse, it sets a very clear, in their mind, vendor is manufacturer barcode, it's just packed in big cases and off it goes. We have to sticker seller.
Yeah. Okay.
And it, you know, it costs a little bit, but it's a way to, it's a good way of just sort of separating the two sides of the.
So you're effectively saying you're happy to pay for the extra barcode and requirement because it drives a thought process internally that probably saves you cash.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately after that, you want to leverage your not agency partners, but your tech partners, you know, the ones who are going to be there to catch all the chargebacks, the ones who are going to be there to improve and the efficiency of how you deal with the orders in regards to vendor and to seller. Yep. You know, it's a very time consuming thing, and we were spending volumes of time trying to do it, get it right. And we just started to plug in tech in the right places. And now it's almost, I would say, almost seamless.
Go on, spill the beans. What tech? What have you plugged in?
Well, from the vendor side, we've got KuCommerce.
He's not here yet.
He's coming. Yeah.
Yep. That's good guys, Chris.
So Ku, that's great. He's really, from a vendor side, has changed everything. From a chargeback side, we use Chargeback. Funny enough.
What does that do?
So again, they're the ones, they can, historically, they can go back 5 years. You know, they can look, pull back anything that you've missed in the past, but also everything now. We don't even have to think about it. It just happens. Yeah. We get an invoice once a month and says, this is the chargebacks we claim back from you, you know, late deliveries, all that kind of stuff. Anything that we could have challenged, we've challenged. We check it again, make sure the refund ends, we pay the invoice, done. Yeah. We don't think about it anymore. And then from the seller side, we've got Katita.
Yep. Yes. Mm. Jim's coming in for lunch.
Oh, there you go.
There we are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Small Amazon ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly.
On the chargeback, have you got any process around that? It's great getting the cash back, but do you then proactively look at the reasons for leaking cash and then fix those processes? So I guess you're trying to ultimately reduce how much cash back you're trying
to get. Yeah, I mean, in the past, we would always look and figure out what was causing it, and that's when we brought the tech. So Ku handles to make sure that the what we accepted was actually what we had stock and that kind of thing. So the PO matched the stock level. So that's the first one. So make sure we can then fulfill the orders. Behind that was the warehouse and the SOPs. That is where, you know, making sure what we actually said we picked correctly, you know. And then, you know, outside of that, just making sure you have a good courier, making sure you're delivering on time.
Yeah.
You know, anything that's flagged up as an issue, we jump on and we fix straight away. You know, but you just got to put the time in.
This is the whole point I wanted to make. All the conversation that you've been having just shows how much work has to go on in the background in order to operationally be successful. Yeah. Like the testing, the SOPs that you've got in place, everything is set, tested, and it's all run on data and how that works for you as a business. And every business is so different. So the amount of work that goes on in the background is phenomenal, and that has to happen with every single business that wants to grow on Amazon and do well.
I think comfort's the killer of progress, if you know what I mean. It's like kind of being stuck in a bit of like a velvet prison, if you can say it like that. We're generating sales, we're generating income, it's great, but putting in the hard graft and asking the hard questions, like, are we actually delivering correctly? Are we delivering on time? Why are we not confirming 100% of our orders? Why is our fill rate falling down?
How much is it costing us?
Yeah, how much is it costing us to do all of that? You need to do that hard work and constantly tweak and refine it. It's not just like, hey, Ant, well done, you smashed it, and then let's just forget about it for the next year or two. You need to constantly audit it every quarter, every 6 months, every year. Is your tech partner still the right person? Are your logistical providers still giving you the best bang for your buck? Yep. Do you need to negotiate new rates? It's a constantly evolving process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's probably also depending on the life cycle of the business when they're dealing with Amazon themselves. I mean, if I look back at my career, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you were maybe a bit more complacent. You were like, are we doing something? It's fine for 6 months, for a year. You could let it go. Now you have to be watching it all the time. And that's also because of Amazon's progression. Yes. Amazon's requirements are so, I'm going to use the word strict, and I'm not sure if that can even work, but they're far stricter than what they used to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they are. I think Amazon's been on that journey. I guess like a lot of e-commerce businesses, COVID put a lot of fuel on the fire for digital businesses, and dare I say it created quite an easy environment. And I think what you've seen post-COVID has been that right-sizing, if that's the right way of looking at it. Amazon are no longer just going grow, grow, grow. It's how do I make this much more commercial as a channel? I've heard so many brands come under so much more pressure, whether it's from a net PPM point of view, looking at their Amazon P&L and seller, it is tighter. You know, nobody from Amazon's come along in the last few years and gone, we've got a lower net PPM expectation, storage fees are going down, and FBA fees are going to go through the floor. Everybody's getting squeezed from every single angle. What still amazes me, I would hazard a guess that 75% of our conversations as an agency still start in the upper part, in the growth and the marketing part. How do I get bigger? How do I take more market share? How do I beat a competitor? Very few conversations start from how do I make more money from my existing business? Chargeback projects really excite me when we get them traveling. It's not about the money we can give back to a client. It's what does it unearth behind the scenes? Mm. Why have they been paying money back to Amazon? And that for me unearths that, like I say, in the P&L, what sits there is a little cogs line, that dirty little one line that contains 50 odd different elements of what does it cost you to get your product into Amazon. A cashback project can unearth a multitude of sins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fully agreed. Like, if you've got catalog issues, I mean, start at the source. Obviously, it'll help you unearth it with some of the chargebacks. Yeah. But I've seen in the past where cost prices, for example, are round off to three, or they have three decimal points when you do the upload instead of two, and then it's not seen as the correct price. You know what I mean? It's instead of £7.50, it's 7.502. That two is irrelevant in like the grand scheme of things, but to Amazon it's not the correct price.
So yes,
small things like that can really just hammer it, and if you don't know what you're looking for, you don't know what you're going to find, essentially. Like that,
you hit home with that comment about it's always grow, but with Amazon now it's you grow but grow better.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
It's all for the growth, but you have to be better.
Yeah,
I think playing in the Amazon environment now is becoming more expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Every year the CPCs are going up. You know, Amazon is flooding us with charges, and they're making things up, and they're just like, we're going to charge you for this and charge you for that. You know, and now they're going to charge you for, I think the latest one I saw was a day. It's sort of days left of stock. If it gets too low, they're going to charge you. So it's like if they run you down to 7 days, they charge you now as well. So you have to do everything you can do internally first if you're going to make Amazon win.
Yes.
And again, we've said it, you know, it's a full picture. It's going to cost you more to play on the platform, but if you want to play, if you want to generate that money to play on the platform, look what you're doing in-house first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't build on shaky foundations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, we've talked a lot about a lot of different things. What about a little bit of around the table? What operational advice, what one bit of advice do you think that Amazon brands should be taking on board from an operational perspective?
Don't be afraid to ask the hard questions internally. If they're saying that you don't agree with, go to your VM, go to your AVS and ask them, like, why am I being charged? Is there a way that you can help me fix this? Especially during AVN, go in and say, look, I want to make this work for you. I don't fully understand the process. Help me to make it better. Mm-hmm. Amazon doesn't want to waste time in the warehouses looking for orders or repacking or reshaping or breaking down and breaking up. It's just a waste of time. Obviously, they do charge you for it, but ultimately, they'd probably rather avoid it. So don't be afraid to ask the hard questions and also do a lot of self-reflection. I mean, ask your industry peers. If you have someone that you look up to in the industry and you have a connection, don't be afraid to reach out and ask them and say, look, guys, what issues are you seeing in the market and what are you doing well in the market and can I get some advice? Don't be afraid to create a playbook. It's back to the SOP bit that you mentioned.
No.
Don't be afraid to ask and be, I don't say vulnerable, because Amazon...
Oh, that's dangerous.
Amazon will ravage you for that, but... be open and just have the open conversation. If you have a good relationship with your VM and your AVS, just have a frank conversation with them and just say, look, I'm being hammered on these metrics. How can I make it work for you to make it work for us type thing? Develop a give-get relationship.
I think the point I just want to catch on that is there's probably a lot of businesses who are on Vendor Central who don't have a VM. You know, it's like, how do, you know, like us exactly, we don't have a VM. We don't see the value in it. So ultimately is where do we get that information from? You've got seller support, and half the time seller support, you get a copy and paste. And you go.
Have a nice day.
You don't get
it's
the answers you want.
It's not most of the time, it's all the time.
It's all the time. I was trying to be nice. So, I think going to Amazon for answers is not always the answer itself. I think you need to leverage the community around you. There are a lot of people who've been there, done it before, who are more than willing to probably help you and answer the questions you might have. It's just, you just need to find the right place to do it. So it's going to the conferences, it's doing that, it's networking, it's making those connections. You know, I'm finding people on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We've all been there, we've all done it. I just think ultimately, you know, if we don't want to picture Amazon as a big bad beast, but they are a big bad beast.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
Amazon, if you're watching.
Yeah, I mean, I'm done now.
That's our agency partnership. Absolutely screwed. Yeah. Thank you, mate. It's been a pleasure having you.
Yeah.
Catalog delisted, everything. Just have a nice day.
I think this is a case of, you know, we need the answers are within the community.
Mm-hmm. For me, from a seller perspective, it's the forums. to the Amazon Seller forums. I think there are such niche issues within Seller Central itself. Popping onto a forum and seeing what other people are struggling with, mm-hmm. literally searching for that problem that you're having, you're going to get more of an answer from multiple Amazon sellers through that forum than you are from Amazon itself. Yeah. And for me, through Seller Central, stop putting in cases and chatting. Do the call me back.
Speak to them.
The amount of times that you get the copy and paste answers, you get the, I'm going to forward this to another member of the team to look into it, doesn't work. Pick up the phone, give them that urgency through your voice, and it makes such a difference.
There's also another subtle difference in that. Yeah, we all know what's behind the scenes is ultimately a call center or customer service operation. Every reply to a ticket bounces to the next person. Yep. Nobody has ownership. Nobody has accountability. You've got someone on the phone. The only way they're breaking that accountability is when it goes exactly that trap. Yep. They can't escape. And you can see the problem through. You might have to make a couple of calls, but you're going to get so much more ownership, and you'll speak to two or three people, yep. not 15 or 20.
Yep.
Charlie, I think hitting your little tip, there's something else I want to pull out of that, which is you said something along the lines of, if you're getting charged for it, it's probably because you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that there's real your value hidden in that. Amazon are not charging you for it because they want to penalise you. It is a punishment, but it's not for the sake of it. Amazon will penalise you with a chargeback or a penalty on a vendor account if you've got something wrong, because it costs them money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I love the chargeback process. Getting the cash back on a no-win, no-fee basis is brilliant. Getting your cash back whilst at the same time being told this is what we penalised you for gives you that tip, that clue to think, well, where do we go in the operation to fix this and prevent that in the future? Mm-hmm. So my one bit of advice, just to build on yours, would be run a chargeback audit or look at all of your existing chargebacks and penalties and billings that are coming from Amazon and ask why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go and fix it, because you've probably got five things there that might save you 1, 2, 3. We sometimes see 6% of their turnover coming back on a chargeback project.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that could be 6% that you pay for your SOAs for your next deal event. You know what I mean? It could be money that goes back into your advertising budget. You just recycle it into your business, back into P&L. Every account manager would love to go to their senior manager. I mean, Andy, I'd love to come to you with a big bag of cash and be like, check how much cash I saved us, Andy.
What time's that meeting?
Yeah. I have to go dig it out the boot. But you know what I mean? You want to go to your senior leadership teams with wins, with income, and also with solutions. It's not just like, cool, I've made money and then I'm making more next month, but I actually only put a Band-Aid on the wound and not actually healed the wound, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Get to the source of the problem.
Yeah, and I think as annoying as it is, I think you need to sign up to those emails, the notifications when they come through and they say, here's a chargeback, here's an issue. A lot of people probably don't do that, and they just live in the world of happy ignorance.
Yeah.
Where actually, where you need if you get the emails, then you know you have a problem.
Yeah,
because Amazon's, it's set up to help you. You just got to know how to leverage it to help you.
That's it.
Bring that to life. We must have done 40, 50 cashback projects.
Minimum. Yeah.
And we always talk to clients about your 2-6% of turnover is typically what we can pull back. And our most disappointing project ever was one client where we thought we'd pull that back, and it came back and was about $2,000, because the client was operationally absolutely watertight. They were absolutely brilliant in that respect. That's 1 out of 40 or 50 projects. And the sad news is too many businesses on Amazon, on vendor, are accepting that as a cost of doing business. That's just what it costs me to do business with Amazon. No, it doesn't. It's because operationally, you're getting something wrong. Fix it, nail it. If you're leaking 2-4% of your P&L to Amazon because you're operationally not tight enough, that's serious margin when it comes to an Amazon channel. Some brands are netting down to 10-20%. If you can put 2-6 back in, wow.
Yeah, no, we've seen it with clients where they've got a designated person that just sits and disputes it all week. They'll spend 3 days out of their week sitting and doing disputes every month.
That's
every
a thankless job.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
valuable, but
I mean, I'd
need
want
some coffee to get through that.
I'd want to drop kick my laptop if I do that so many times every day. The thing about where you could be rather redirecting those skills and that value, building strategy. If it's someone that's got a good mindset and they can spot all these issues, why have them doing a job that tech can do? You know what I mean? It's like you're paying someone to essentially go back on what they're good at. So it's like, use that, redirect the skills, put it into strategy, put it into advertising, put it into negotiation where they really shine, and let the tech do the work.
Yeah.
So where's it all going? We've talked how Amazon has become a little bit tighter, hence operations becoming more important. What's the crack for the next couple of years from an operations perspective?
Do the work. Like you said, do the work internally. You truly have to make sure that you're doing the testing, you've got the data to back you, and it may be costly to start, but for the long run, it's going to do you so much better.
And I think
put the time in.
And I think they're going to be on like a profitable growth sort of curve. When I was at Amazon, it was selection. Any selection you can get in. Yeah. My VM would do backflips with joy if I could go in and be like, hey, I put extra 50 ASINs on this catalog. It's going to bring in sort of income. Once COVID started hitting, they were like, ooh, okay, you know, we need profitability now. We're actually hemorrhaging money.
We also didn't have space either, did they? Yeah. All that new stuff.
Well, that's it. So with the amount of new sellers coming on, the new brands where they're going directly with brand with vendor now generally and sort of bypassing resellers or distributors, I think it's just going to grow the curve in all honesty, but they're going to want to grow the selection piece to make it the one-stop shop for everything that you can get on Amazon, but at a profit. They're not going to just list things for the fun of it anymore, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you can already see lower cost items are being disregarded, you know, sort of that £6, £7, £8 mark. If you're not in there already, Amazon's going, ooh, I don't know.
That's it.
You know, they're taking a double take now, where before you could drop something for £3 and they'd be like, yep, okay.
Yeah,
cool. That's Temu now. Temu's
And I mean, you've seen them open their sort of secondary channel
Amazon
in
Hall.
The States. Yeah,
yeah, it's open now. They've got the
beta. And they've got it, and it's now just arrived in the UK. So
it's very flashy.
We're moving that way for the lower cost items. And the problem is you're going to have bigger brands who don't want to put their lower cost items on something like that because they seem it's going to devalue them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an interesting cat and mouse game over the next couple of years to see how Amazon negotiates that with, you know, the brands who are there who are wanting to list their sort of their £5 item, but they don't want to put it into the low cost.
Yeah.
Side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because ultimately that is probably going to be deemed as the same as Temu and Shein. Yep. And that kind of stuff. So I don't know, it's going to be very interesting whatever it is, but ultimately the one thing we can say is do the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think that's the thing for me. You said something really interesting, Trav, about Amazon now as from a vendor point of view cutting out the middleman and going direct to brand. Yep. I think there's something that in itself was interesting when it happened, but I think there's something really telling in what they're doing there, which is margin focus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't want to buy off a middleman who's buying off the brand, who's holding a bit of margin. Everything I've seen from Amazon, seller costs going up, storage fees going up, trying to manage how much you've got in the warehouse so they can be efficient on the warehouse space. Vendor, if I hear net PPM once more, from it, that, how often do we hear that in the week? Pressure on net PPM. Everywhere is being squeezed. Amazon is not in that growth, list more mode.
No.
It's still there, it's still a message. This is, consolidation is the wrong word, but Amazon is about margin. That's where they are now.
It's that will put grow more, better.
Yeah, exactly, it's growing better. And for mm-hmm. brands, that will put massive pressure on them.
Mm-hmm.
When you look down that P&L, whether it's vendor or seller, you can't change Amazon's referral fees. Good luck changing how much Amazon buy from you for on there. Yeah, there we are. Yeah, good luck with your vendor negotiations.
Cost for us negotions.
There's a topic there in itself. But
you try to sneak it through on the slide. They're like, no.
Yeah, coming a mile away.
So what you do control is your own operation.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's where there's going to be some nice, probably a necessity for brands to look, do the work, get into the skin of it because you are going to come under pressure, but also some real interesting opportunity for brands. So it's not all negative. It's not this pressure you've got to fix it. It's there's some brands, many brands are making very, very good money on Amazon. And some very lazy brands. We see this in cashback projects. If we're pulling cashback, for me, they're operationally lazy.
Yeah.
And that's probably a bit of a bold statement. But
it's true, though.
It is. Yeah. I think it is. And there's money to be made.
I mean, ultimately, I think the businesses must think is they want to put people like chargeback out of business because they want to sew up their operations so well that there isn't any cash to get back.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And let's not pretend, I know I said that Amazon are penalising you on chargebacks, and we're talking about this a lot, but it's an indicator that you're getting something wrong.
Yeah.
They're not just doing it because they're getting wrong. There is a margin in there, probably quite a healthy margin in there for Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
But in the ideal world, you're operationally watertight. It makes Amazon's life easier. The stock's coming in at the right size, on the right time, labelled in the right way, whether that's FBA or seller. And everybody's happy. I guess that's the world that everybody wants to head towards.
Yeah, they don't need to do bin checks or vendor. You like raise a ticket. Can you do a bin check?
I mean, that's a secret weapon.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? It also takes time. It takes effort from your side. I mean, I know it's raising a ticket, but I mean, if you need to do it all the time or you've got brands that have like 50,000 ASINs or whatever like that, it's going to take a lot of time. So if your case back quantities are wrong or they're receiving it wrong, and then you need to sort of go and update that, Amazon needs to do manual checks. It's just all extra slowdowns essentially in the entire process. Yeah.
Yeah. It's cost.
And it's cost, yeah. Time is literally money when it comes to that.
That's exactly where it comes from.
It's changed in the seller world now, where we are constantly looking at it line by line, SKU by SKU, and monitoring the operational efficiency by SKU, not just your overall catalogue. More and more
profitability.
Yeah, profitability. It's down to the absolute nitty gritty now. It's completely different.
Dare I say it sounds like retail.
Yeah, it is
yeah. And that's exactly what it is. It's I was having a chat with Jonathan, my business partner, yesterday about how close our business as an agency is to actually being a retailer. We feel the pressure and behave much more like a retailer in our business. And retail is ruthless, absolutely ruthless. You're fighting for the penny, not for the pound in retail. And
P&L meetings in retail, whoa. Yeah. They were not enjoyable. And it's getting to that point now where we are looking at P&L detail, looking at what's missed from the P&L and really going, drilling granular. Right down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's been a good conversation, guys. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we could talk all day about it, but I'm not sure that everybody watching has actually got all day to listen to us get frustrated about Amazon.
Unfortunately
talking
not.
About operational success.
Yeah. Look, thank you very much to each and every one of you for joining us. Thank you to you guys that have joined us to listen to this episode of our Let's call it a podcast. We'll call it a podcast from now on. That's where we are.
We've joined the club.
We're in the club.
We're in the club.
So keep your eye open. This is one of many. This is the new journey that we're on with our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm sure you'll be finding us on our live platforms. You'll be finding us on Spotify, YouTube, and many more. If Whitney's doing her job as well as she has done in organising this for us today, I'm sure you'll all know about that in the not too distant future. But thanks again for your time, guys, our guests and joining us. And thanks to you guys for watching and joining today. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Cool. Thank you.